This is an interview with William Dove at the Top of Monte Carlo Laboratory. Today is August 23rd, 2013. I am Molly Loss. So Dr. Dove, I'd like you to talk about some other faculty who were important to your work here and in your life in Monte Carlo.
Right. So Monte Carlo has a small number of faculty. It's ranged between 15 and 20 during the time that I've been on its faculty. And I've gotten to know every one of them at the research level, thanks to this pattern of Monte Carlo's faculty meeting mostly being research. I've talked about the importance of the directorships and the associate director that is especially important, Betty Miller. So in my own life in Monte Carlo and in personal life outside the laboratory, some of these faculty and their wives have been important part of our medicine community. So I can mention Dick Burgess and his wife Anne, Bill Sugden and his wife Donata, Mike Hoffman and his wife Lynn, Jerry Mueller and his wife Alice. All of these are people that we've enjoyed outside Monte Carlo. And I think that though Monte Carlo itself hasn't been the sort of family that it was when Rush was its director, this has been a subgroup of the faculty who are more like family. The rest have been part of the community. Now, what I want to emphasize then in talking about Monte Carlo as a community is the importance of the academic staff, especially the long-term academic staff. And these are staff beginning with Helen Iverson, the original business manager of the department, and she was succeeded by Randy Martinson. Both of these people have really the community at heart. Their whole mantra is to try to help other people do good work. And they've known everybody in the department and made sure that the funding was under control and not out of bounds. Beyond these two business managers, Helen and Randy, come two important academic staff at Ilse Riegel and Betty Sheehan. So these are, Ilse eventually was designated a senior scientist. Betty was an administrator on the academic staff who, and in both cases, had a lot to do with all of the students, all of the postdocs, all of the faculty, all of the grants that we were putting together, really created a sort of glue by personal interaction. And again, these are two people whose whole mantra has been to help people do good work, and they each have special skills, special interpersonal skills that have been essential to Monte Carlo as a community. So there are other 10th floor long-term staff that to mention beyond Karen Schwartz and her colleague Chris, The ones that I have the most to do with are the pair of word processing so-called typists, Mary Jo Markham and Kristen Adler. So here, in this particular part of McArdle's continuity, they've both been on the staff. They're not academic staff, but they've been on the staff of McArdle since, I guess, the mid-70s anyway, a good 30 years, something like that. They both were trained at MATC, now called Madison College, and they've acquired more and more skill and responsibility for word processing, for organizing various databases that help in McArdle. And when I think of them, I think of a little phrase that I call the power of two, because these are two people who know each other's jobs completely. If one of them is sick, the other one can take over. They completely cover for one another, yet much of what is needed in McArdle does require two people, but they are complementary to each other, and it's a really beautiful source of continuity where we don't have to look for some kind of LTE to fill a gap. The two of them completely cover the needs for word processing and other data management to keep McArdle going. A person who's been on the staff non-faculty for the longest, I think even longer than Helen Iverson, should also be recognized, and that's Don Fechner. And Don Fechner is a very handy person, can fix almost anything, and I expect he's well into his 80s, but comes in several days a week, every week, and if there's equipment that needs fixing, he does it. And Don has this loyalty to McArdle that was expressed in the following way. Last spring we organized a little booklet for Alexandra. It was a big birthday for her. It was called Do Good Work. And a number of people in McArdle who have worked with us, in particular with Alexandra, wrote little testaments. And this included Don, who said something like, I hope that the work we do for McArdle really helps to address the problem of cancer. So here he is fixing equipment and yet relating to the agenda that McArdle stands here for. I found that really a moving testament, and one that I feel the faculty should recognize in regard to our community. Here's a person, part of our community, who feels this commitment. He does his work because he hopes it helps address the problem of cancer.
Didn't you tell me that Don Fechner also couldn't retire? He tried to retire?
Well, he did try to retire, right, and told me, right? So you remember that somehow. Right. So when he did try to retire, he came back rather quickly, saying that at home all he heard was honeydew, and that he'd rather fix things for McArdle than at home. He has a happy marriage as far as I know, but anyway, he'd rather work here. All right, so I'm talking about continuity and McArdle as a community for which the people I've been mentioning are really key. And I've not mentioned them all, but everyone that I know who's on the permanent McArdle staff has been important. And these who I have mentioned are especially important. So this then, as I said, McArdle stands in the middle of campus, so it really, given this structure, it allows postdocs and graduate students to come in from everywhere on campus, from all kinds of programs. McArdle has its own cancer biology program that's now interdepartmental also. But basically, McArdle is a sort of scientific meeting building in which people, graduate students and postdocs who want to do research on cancer, gather together. And I think it's a really serious question to ask. Do these people feel like slaves? Do they feel part of the community? Do they have much to do with the governance of the organization? I think those are serious questions to ask, and I'm not prepared to give an answer to them. They're ones that I ask. I ask them specifically these days by a couple of things. One, we mentioned McArdle Seminar, that is Jim Shull's hope for building community. And one thing that Carolyn Alexander and I have done, and in fact discussed more just this noon, was a way in which students can interact with the colloquiums, with the seminar speaker, and pursue in more depth their own interest in what's being discussed. So it's been called Speaker Chat, and it's operated strictly on a volunteer basis. It wouldn't happen except for Kristen Adler, who organizes it. So I know that my two graduate students do feel access to visiting speakers because of Speaker Chat. The second thing that I've been doing is a kind of pilot in regard to the younger members of the rotating members of the McArdle community is called Community Talks, and this is strictly informal. Maybe every 2 or 3 months, a person whose path I cross, who is doing something interesting outside of the lab, prepares a talk about it, and sometimes we call it episcience. That everybody, almost everybody, has a passion outside of the lab. It's not for drinking beer, it's not for the Green Bay Packers, that happens with everybody, but a personal passion. And so I love to ride my bicycle to and from work, so I gave a community talk about what I see on my bike ride, because I go through the Arboretum, and the Arboretum changes with the season, and I, one year, made photographs each different season, each different place of interest to me. So I gave a community talk on my bicycle ride, and there are people on McArdle faculty who like to ride a bicycle, and people on the staff, the graduate students, and so on. So this is of common interest. Karen Schwartz, she's crazy about polar bears, loves polar bears. She took a trip to the Arctic, so she gave a community talk on the life of polar bears in the Arctic. And Dick Burgess, he loves rocks. His house is full of rocks. So he gave a talk about rock hounding and archaeology in Wyoming, which is what he's been doing several summers. My graduate student, Amy Irving, has married a Chinese person, and so she, as a Westerner, took a trip with her husband to China and gave a community talk. So these community talks are attended by a very small number of people. It's not yet pervasive at all to McArdle. I don't know whether it'll come to be, but anyway, it's something that I've been interested to explore, whether it's a way that people will interact with each other on a sort of common basis.
Do you think that you mentioned that McArdle is kind of a hub for cancer research in the middle of the campus? Do you think that'll change when McArdle moves to its new location?
Well, it might very well. I am thinking about that because McArdle will be in the middle. It's already under pressure to give up some of its space to other departments. Is it going to have an identity scientifically when it's in the middle of the second of three big towers and each floor being the length of a football field, and the labs being open labs, at least for now, where people 100 yards away are in the same space? It's going to be quite different from here. So there'll be a large amount of adaptation to that circumstance, and will McArdle be able to express its identity along with adapting to that new circumstance? I'd say the major opportunity for that, if it can, is through its weekly seminar, which ideally can be one that the whole set of medical research groups can attend, because there are people in other departments interested in cancer. Ideally, if McArdle's faculty can really stand behind and promote a attractive weekly seminar series, then it will, its identity can be expressed, and its strengths that come out of this search-based faculty meeting can be expressed. So that's a hope. I don't know how likely it is to happen, but anyway, it will be a new era. I'll just put it that way.
So you mentioned a little bit earlier Jim Scholl, the present director of McArdle. Did you want to talk about him some?
Well, I said that he's different from his three predecessors in not having an automatic connection to the individual faculty groups. So he comes, though he was a postdoc here, he comes from elsewhere. Unlike Rush, he didn't hire. He's not yet hired any of the people. All of our new faculty were hired when Norman was director. So he comes from the outside. He has some scientific affinity to our group, to Michael Gould's group. So he's working at a disadvantage, where he's trying to create connections is through the McArdle seminar, but Jim Scholl has told me he's disappointed in the amount of participation by our faculty in that seminar, so it isn't yet working for him. He has this year tried to build a leadership group of five faculty that will give more connection through the department. And my understanding from talking to Mike Hoffman, who's one of those, and Carolyn Alexander, who's another of those, is that indeed this group is functioning well. It does meet every other week, and it does reach consensus. We haven't yet seen an example of its consensus moving to the whole faculty, but at least this leadership group is working within itself to solve problems. So it's a work in progress. I'd say that this year will tell whether through this mechanism of leadership group and through monitoring the move to Wimmer, Jim Schull is seen as a leader. So it's a work in progress.
I'd also like to ask you about your memories of Jim and Betty Miller. Your memories of Jim and Betty Miller?
Right. Well, these were highly, highly committed to research. Worked very well together. Became highly respected nationally. And McArdle was a major player in the American Association for Cancer Research, or AACR. And I know that in Betty's early days as a young lass, she often went to the AACR, and as did Ilse Riegel, and McArdle had a large role to play. The Millers were part of that, and their people, their alumni, would go to the AACR. So national leaders, highly respected nationally in cancer. And I'd say that was true of Van Potter, Ros Boutwell, and Harold Rush, Jerry Mueller, this founding group, and Aunt Henry Pito, but became less true with the newer faculty. Certainly Howard Temin wasn't part of that sort of AACR cancer establishment, and I have not been. My national and international connections are quite different. So Jim and Betty Miller brought a focus on cancer research that was implemented nationally through the AACR and locally through their lab, which was a very well-run lab with a complement between the chemistry of Jim Miller and the biology of Betty Miller. As you know, Betty died of cancer. One of the early faculty who developed cancer, Charlie Heidelger another, and Howard Temin a third. The three of them were lost prematurely. A photo that Betty knows very well that would illustrate the commitment of Betty Miller is and when she was failing with her kidney cancer. She wanted a photograph of the whole faculty out at the east end of McArdle, and there was Betty in her wheelchair in front of everybody. That's the way she wanted to be seen as part of our faculty to the end. I think Jim Miller, he had very strong opinions. Even when he became emeritus, he very often injected his opinions into McArdle faculty discussions. But he had a soft side to him as well. If you ever needed help, he was really take his shirt off his back to help. So publicly, he had a sort of brusque affect, but privately, he had a soft affect. Mm-hmm. would say that the warmth that they had for each other could be expressed to others, and I certainly felt that when they were when they knew that they were just about finished, I certainly felt a warmth from both of them.
Can I ask you about your memories of Charlie Heidelberger?
Right. Well, so he was my neighbor when I first arrived. He's the one who had to break the news to me that my lab actually wasn't quite finished. It was almost finished. I had waited 9 months working out at Stanford for it to be finished. But anyway, and I think that we had a number of sort of bonds at the beginning. He had, first of all, the chemistry that I understood as well. Secondly, interested in music. He was an avid trumpet player. His music wasn't the same as ours, but music was his outside passion. If I were giving community talk, I would ask Charlie to perform on the trumpet, which he would do at AACR meetings. That was his outside passion. He became quite famous and would be traveling a lot, traveling to Europe, and he would give the equivalent of community talks on some of the places he would go to in Europe. Basically a slideshow way back then. He eventually had to leave McArdle because he was divorced. He had a wife who didn't relate to Madison at all, and he took a position out at Los Angeles. He actually didn't live much beyond that, but anyway, it was a bittersweet ending to what was a really important McArdle research program, the development of various chemotherapeutic agents. 5-FU still lives on in honor of what Charlie did. It's the core of most of the chemotherapeutics used for colon cancer now, and it's not curative. But these various formulations have really improved the quality of life of people with advanced colon cancer, including my brother-in-law. So you can't ignore that contribution, and there are not many who've done such an important thing for cancer.
So, can I ask you about students who were important to your work?
Right, well, Betty gave me a list, and it would be, we would have to stay hours for me to give an appreciation of each of these people. Each is different, each is special to me. And some have been successful, some have not, but they've each, you know, tried, and they've been people who've interacted. So I think what I would mostly want to concentrate on are the sort of transition people who joined the lab and participated in some cases actually caused changes of direction. And I said at the beginning that though I'm talking about our research in the first person, it's always involved our group and sometimes other groups. So my first student, and so that's a transition from being a postdoc and doing all my own experiments. My first student was Finn Haugli, a young man from Oslo, who came with his bride, Kari, And Finn was able to work beside me on Lambda to learn microbial genetics, mutagenesis. He then worked between our group and Harold Rush's group in using some of those methods on Fusarium, which had no genetics, and which he was able to contribute to some of the early stages of making Fusarium a genetically sophisticated organism to use genetics to study that cell cycle. Mm-hmm. We remained friends with Finn and Kari Hoagly. This is the mid-60s that he joined the lab. We've remained friends ever since. And he came back on sabbatical in the late 80s to learn some of the molecular genetics that we had by that time developed for Fusarium. In my era of working on phage lambda, an important figure was Mark Firth, who was in the cell and molecular biology program and already had, as an undergraduate at Harvard, had learned quite a bit of microbial genetics, so he came basically with his feet on the ground already, and we had gotten to a point where we needed to do a lot of molecular analysis of the replication system, which he then was able to organize in his thesis. In between Finn Hoagly and Mark Firth was a really important postdoctoral person, Hachiro Inoguchi. He came from Kyoto, and I'd given a talk in Tokyo in 1968 about our early work on the replication system, and he wanted to join. And so he was already well trained in microbial genetics and developed some very sophisticated genetic screens, strains that in fact we still have. I do imagine if I ever stop working on animals and have to have a large grant to support that I could carry this little box of strains anywhere in the world, and if I have a water bath and an incubator, I could do the next experiment that has to be done within a day or two. But Hachiro was a person who created a lot of really important strains with which to study the replication system of Lambda. And he was really, and probably still is, was forced to retire, but he works in some biotechnology companies in Japan. He's still so inventive at microbial genetics and developing strains. I've talked while discussing the 10th floor academic staff in Japan. There's a really important culture to understand. It's the culture of the organization. And that he, junior to his professor, was always completely loyal to his professor, and he translated that here, always completely loyal to me. But when his professor retired, the other faculty were not prepared to promote him to be the professor until the last year of his position on the faculty back in Japan. They held him back because he had been too helpful to other people. He hadn't adopted the new style that the Japanese academics wanted, the more Western style of being the sort of leader of and the boss. He hadn't developed that persona of being the boss. He was always the helper. And so in a way he got caught in a culture shift back in Japan. while he was here. He was just such a wonderful, creative person in working forward in our Lambda phase. So there are many people in that phase that I, you know, am very fond of and stay in touch with. So I think we'd be here much too long if I talked about each of them. I've talked about some sort of game-changing people, a very small subset, who just happened to be at a time that we were shifting. So when we then began to follow Finn Hogley's thesis and develop Fusarium, some key people came along in that decade of the mid-70s to the early 90s, decade and a half, mid-70s to the early 90s. And one of them was a graduate student, again in this CMB program, named Tim Shadle. And he joined our lab in part on the recommendation of Mark Firth. And just as Mark had been able to do a lot of things himself, so was Tim Shadle developing an analysis of the genetic system controlling the mitotic apparatus, the microtubules, the tubulin of the microtubules. And Tim Shadle developed that genetics and discovered a way to tease apart that genetic system to find out how many genes there were they linked to each other, or were they scattered through the genome. He used methods that had come along in mammalian genetics, human genetics, but Fusarium needed those methods, and Tim was the one to make them work. And working with Fusarium, he was able to work with the organism because of a postdoctoral fellow, Tim Berland. So Tim Shadle and Tim Berland. So I met Tim Berland in the mid-70s when he was still a graduate student at a conference in Wales. And he had then, after getting his degree, gone to Finn Hogley, but then decided he wanted to work here. So he came here and really amplified the work with Fusarium that we had begun in the 70s. So Berland with all of the biology and Shadle with all of the molecular biology made Fusarium a really respectable organism with which to study the growth cycle and the differentiation that Fusarium shows. So this was recognized around the world as a coming organism. At the same time that yeast was really the dominant eukaryotic microbe, this was a coming, arising organism. And it had cellular structures more like that of mammalian cells, whereas yeast, some people have called a higher prokaryote. Fusarium is in fact a true eukaryote with visible chromosomes and structures that one finds in higher forms. So Keith Gull was a faculty member at Canterbury and joined our group that was being led by the two Tims. So double Tim and Keith. And Keith brought a lot of electron microscopy and morphological analysis. And in his 1 year here, he really made some major contributions to the kind of morphological analysis, cell biological analysis that we've come to use. Keith reciprocally learned a lot of genetics and molecular genetics in particular from us, and then was able to use that when he went back to England, first to Canterbury, then to Manchester. Now he's head of a unit in Oxford University and was recently knighted Sir Keith Gall. Had great success. But he certainly gave great success to us. So those are the Lambda and Fusarium key personnel who've been in our lab, who've made big changes. Our work in the mouse, of course, would not have happened at all without Alexandra, because as I told you, when she wanted to get back into research after our kids had gotten into primary school, then mouse genetics needed what we felt could be done. That is to begin to mutate particular genes in the germline and study their effects in vivo, not work in cell culture, not some disembodied biology, but work in vivo, what's happening in the mouse, in development and in cancer. So she was able to develop that between about 1978 and 1983, those 5 years, seeing her mice every day, but on her own schedule. We weren't funded. We had no track record in doing mouse genetics. Though we had studied and we knew quite a bit about it, we had no grant to work in that area. But both Harold Rush and then Henry Pitot and then Norman Drinkwater supported our work, and the Millers and Ros Botwell were phasing down their own research in the late 70s, early 80s, phasing down their own research, and so there was space with which we could work in a very well-run animal facility that Ros and Betty had been responsible for establishing and running. So we were able to develop what we felt was needed to understand mammalian biology at the whole organism level. So it started with Alexandra, but then came postdoctoral people, Amy Moser and Larry Johnson. Larry coming from the Jackson Lab, which is a real important part that I'll mention when we talk about personal history. The Jackson Lab in Maine that we had contact with for a long time, even back into the early 70s. But Larry Johnson came from one of the strong labs at the Jackson Lab, and developed problems that we had identified while working at Pasteur and learning mouse genetics. There are problems in immunogenetics that Larry was interested in. Amy Moser, again trained in a good lab at Michigan, was also interested in immunology and wanted to find mutants affected in certain molecules expressed on lymphocytes. And so with the methods that Alexandra had developed for mutagenesis, Amy set up a mutagenesis screen looking for, quite specifically, for loss of certain key lymphocyte antigens. The mutagenesis that Alexandra had perfected was very efficient. It was creating new mutations in known genes at very high efficiency. And it was so efficient that when Amy spotted a kindred that had come out of a mutagenesis that showed a neurological circling defect, she followed it until she discovered, as those animals aged, they developed pale feet, which seems to have nothing to do with a neurological phenotype. And a smart geneticist, she crossed those animals and found that this kindred had two separate mutations in it. I mean, this is unheard of, to have a mutagenesis and get two different mutations in the same sperm, basically. But she would not have followed that line long term had it not been for that other really interesting mutation. But the pale feet, then, we were able to chase down with the help of Henry Pitot, who, as I have mentioned, has done the pathology for lots of labs in McArdle. So with Henry's help, we were able to find out what the cause of the pale feet was, and this is the Min mouse. And it would not have been here except for two things. One, the efficient mutagenesis that Alexander created, and two, the sharp eye and persistence of Amy Moser, who's now on the faculty in human oncology here and working on an aspect of the Min mouse that's particularly interesting to her, that is its breast cancer phenotype. So this was the 80s. Our mouse genetics and now our rat genetics grew from there. And I had a number of very able graduate students in the 90s coming from either genetics or CMB, in some cases from oncology, a series of really excellent people. And you know, for each of them I could take 10 minutes to talk about what they contributed, but this was a string of people who have studied what goes on when tumors form in the Min mouse. When by the early in this millennium, 2004, 2005, when some of the limitations of the Min mouse came up, that's when we asked whether the same kind of mutation in the rat would look more like the human or instead like the mouse, and discovered the PERC rat. So there was a graduate student, Larry Kwong from CMB, and a postdoc, Jim Amos Landgraf. So like many of these later members of our group, there was a strong genetics component. Many of the graduate students in the 90s were genetics doctoral students. And Jim Amos Landgraf got his degree in genetics from Case Western Reserve. And so with those two, Larry Kwong and Jimmy Miss Landgraf, we've developed the PERC rat. A graduate student has joined that effort, Amy Irving, and she's again showing great leadership and a real important part of this whole line of progress.
So if we could switch gears a little bit to talk about some of your on-campus activities. I'm interested in the fact that you helped create the biology core curriculum for undergraduates. Could you describe for me why you decided to get involved with the project?
Well, before I get there, let me make sure that we understand the importance of the academic staff in our own group. So we're talking about personnel in our own group. And so we've had a series of specialists or researchers who've really provided lab continuity, who've been part of the lab for many, many years, spanning much more than one graduate student, 4 or 5 year spell. And so Carol McLeister was the first coming. During the war, she worked in a factory up in Minnesota and had no particular training, but she was much older than any of the graduate students. And she was a great stabilizing force, followed by Natalie Borenstein, again much older, but a very stabilizing force. And now Linda Clipson, who has only a bachelor's degree from McAllister, but it joined our lab in 78, and her abilities have just blossomed during those more than 30 years that she's been in our group. She's able to do anything, and she can make any method better. So this is the long-term continuity at the specialist level inside our group. So returning to the sense of community, what sense of community do our specialists feel, or our graduate students feel? I told you about Amy Irving giving a community talk. Well, Linda Clipson gave a community talk about her trip to Galapagos, and it was attended by most of the 10th floor people. So it really did serve to tie her outside interests to the McArdle fabric broadly. So this question of McArdle as a community actually involves our specialists. Linda is now called a researcher, which is a somewhat higher research level. So anyway, let me come to your question that you've asked about the core curriculum and teaching. When I accepted my faculty position in dealing with Harold Rush, I did ask, did I not have a fixed commitment to teach, that there wasn't some particular course that I had to fit into? And so for my whole career, the teaching that I've chosen to do has been my choice. So in the 1967, the campus was deciding to set up a biology core curriculum that was based on experiments, based on lab, and that it'd be inter-college, that you could take that core curriculum if you were in the Cals or in LNS. The question is, what dean was going to take responsibility? Well, it was the LNS dean who took responsibility for the funding stream that was needed to support this. And so what faculty would want to do this? It wasn't part of anybody's job assignment, especially not mine. But there were four faculty who really wanted to get involved in teaching so-called cell biology, which includes genetics, to undergraduates who wanted to go out of the mainstream and take a lab-based undergraduate course. So the other faculty were Walt Plaut, a microscopist, Bob Metzenberg, a biochemist, myself, and Millard Sussman, a geneticist. So the four of us met together for a whole year to plan out that course and its experiments. And these were all new experiments. They weren't taken out of some textbook somewhere. They were things that we thought would really illustrate one point or another. This was very stimulating. And take my hat off, Harold allowed me to do this. I didn't yet have tenure, but he allowed me to do this. And I continued as the chair of that cell biology for 4 years, when I thought that it was time then for me to build up my research in the early 70s, and I decided that it was time to pass the torch. And Walt Plaut became the chair of that course, and later Millard Sussman, after Walt Plaut died, Millard Sussman became chair of that course. And then finally, none other than Anne Burgess. And Anne, probably from the late 80s or mid 80s, something like that, on for a good 15 years or more, with her personality, was able to recruit a lot of faculty from around the campus to come in with experiments, to set up labs, to really renew what was going on in cell biology. So I, and on the academic staff, I think some sort of honorary faculty position was given her, but certainly not tenure. And is the one who has made the core curriculum what it is today. All we did was get it started in this platform of experiment-based. We made sure that in the 25 lab, there were several groups of students per week, but each group of students would have a good research microscope, a good Zeiss research microscope worth $3,000. We got a dean to spring for that so that they'd have good microscopes to work with, and other things that made these labs dynamic. So all we did was get that started, and others then amplified upon what had been started. This would be an example, Molly, of, I'd say that this isn't the only case where it's been important for me to get to first base, not out there to hit a home run. And in a lot of our research, we've managed to get to first base, and others have sort of carried it around to home plate. I hope this metaphor makes some sense to you. And Betty's father was a baseball coach, so she understands this. And so we got to first base on this, and I'd say that when we talked the first time about our research and I said the importance of early detection, I am determined that we can get to first base to show whether the methods, biological material we've developed, can actually contribute even if it doesn't hit a home run. Okay.
Can we take a pause for a second?
Yeah.
Great.
So, my research is all done in McArdle, and I do care about the McArdle community. McArdle stands in the middle of this university. A lot of our research is dependent on genetics, so I had a lot of scientific interaction with faculty who are only in genetics. There are faculty in McArdle who are also connected to genetics as trainers on the training grant. Mike Hoffman, Chris Bradfield, Norman Drinkwater, at least those three. I think Dick Burgess, also a trainer in genetics. And so one of my ways of interacting with genetics has been done with the most senior member of that faculty, Jim Crow, with whom I worked from 1987 to 2008 for 22 years. The two of us every month edited a column in the journal, the professional journal for those people called genetics, a column in that journal. And it was called Perspectives when Ilse Regal was alive until 04. She was a key editorial assistant for that, and Kristen Adler always was key at managing these manuscripts every month. Genetics, and especially Jim Crow's interests, have to do with human biology. And so does our eventual goal in understanding cancer. This university has departments. I've worked with members of, I once estimated 14 different departments, as many departments where there are people interested in human biology in different ways. And so in 99 and something like 03 and 06, at least three different years, I combined the course that I taught, which was both in genetics and oncology, the course that I taught at the end of the spring, there was a symposium on campus in human biology. And it was a way of trying to bring together the different ways in which people looked at biological problems that that affect our lives. There are biochemists, and there are physicians, and just many different ways. Some people look at people in terms of what disease might they have, others in terms of what athletic skill they might have, what artistic talent they might have. There's so many different ways to look at people, and trying to draw this together. So the very best of those symposia was in 06, but it was a symposium in which there were parallel sessions. There were, in fact, 12 different foci, and it was quite demanding. It was, in fact, the last time I tried to do anything like that, to try to manage so many faculty who all stood forward and so many deans who contributed to making that happen. But for me, it's a way that this university can, as I say, put the U into university. That if you look at other states, and to return to something in which you were interested, are there other places that want us, that have tried to recruit us to work there? Other states like California and New York have divided their disciplines into different cities. So all of the agriculture in California is done at Davis, and the physics is done at UCLA and Berkeley. And the same with New York State. The disciplines are divided, whereas in Madison, they're all pretty much all in Madison. So this university has a, as a research university, has a major opportunity to address such an integrative subject. So as a result of that 06 effort, one of my alumni with whom I still maintain a very active contact, Adam Wilkins, and I wrote a little essay in Perspectives about this symposium and what it brought to bear, and how it brought people who study epigenetic effects and other people who study genetic effects on human biology. But I can say that I don't consider it a complete success, because it became so vast that it wasn't a series of situations where everybody was together. It didn't have a core aspect to it. It was divided by being that vast. And I think for this to be successful, it has to have a sort of core where people are then exposed to different points of view, but they're all together at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's what I think is a better plan. Mm-hmm. But out of that, I did get to know a number of faculty who are in different departments, who are in engineering or in psychology, and I even got to know a person in the art department who became interested in ways to interact with the human biologists. Mm-hmm. All right, so anyway, this has to do with community. The Cancer Center is another major factor to consider on campus here at McArdle. used to have it be its own center. But then in the early 90s, the National Cancer Institute insisted that that Wisconsin have just one center. And so, you know, in the subsequent 20 years or so, there's been this still somewhat unresolved marriage between McArdle and the clinical center. Still unresolved, I would say. Mm-hmm. But many of us in McArdle, including myself, have performed, have served leadership roles in certain of the programs of the Cancer Center. Mm-hmm. And I might ask for a little water if there is any.
Should we pause?
Well, you know, McArdle is here to study cancer, to contribute. The Cancer Center, that's also their agenda. The Cancer Center has a lot of clinical duties. The medical school has large clinical incomes. Clinical members of the medical school recognize that their budget, the amount of funding flowing through the medical school is actually more than half of that to the whole university. I mean, it's a major part of the business done. So those in McArdle are doing their research, and in the current climate, it's very difficult to get funds. Many investigators are short on funds or out of funds, and yet the clinical activity is continuing, and so it's unresolved in regard to what kind of support the Cancer Center itself should be giving to what the basic scientists in McArdle are trying to do. And I think it's very much dependent on who the director of the Cancer Center is, and how well the director of McArdle can interact with that director. Within the last month, the director of the Cancer Center has stepped down. There's going to be a search for a new director. So it's unresolved right now for that reason. We don't know who the new director will be and what kind of interaction we can have, and what kind of consensus of interaction between McArdle, which still feels itself as a unit, and the Cancer Center, which is much more vast. So there's just the difference between basic scientists and clinicians, differences in outlook, differences in funding. So it's a marriage between two cultures. And such marriages only work when, you know, when there's the right personalities in charge and enough of a sense of humor to bridge the gaps in understanding. So anyway, McArdle's faculty have been major players in the way the Cancer Center is configured as basic science programs, and then so-called DOGS, D-O-W-G-S, disease-oriented working groups. And when the Cancer Center applies for funds, it's the programs that are front and center, and the DOGS are sort of filling the gaps between them. And they don't take, they're not at the front of the stage in the way the Cancer Center is presented, and McArdle feels we are the ones who are supporting these programs, cancer genetics, virology, cancer virology. These are all programs that emerge from McArdle's faculty.
So you were, I believe, also interested in talking some about the colleges and departments on human biology. Sort of talk about their role and importance.
The colleges.
And departments on human biology.
Well, there is no department of human biology. There's a department of human ecology, which is that wonderful new building. But there are departments like psychology in which there are people interested in human biology. Richie Davidson is one who was part of this 06 symposium. But engineering, John Yin in biomedical engineering was a very active participant. He's interested in so-called systems biology. So this applies to any biology, but including that of humans. Like the Department of Biochemistry. It's not a human biology department, but there are biochemists who work on particular metabolic diseases. Diabetes, for example, Alan Atty. Mm-hmm. All of these people that I've mentioned were prominent participants in this 06 symposium that we put on.
I believe that's all my questions. That's all right with you. Thank you very much for your time.